Hello, welcome to the world today. I'm Rachel Mealy. This Monday, how will Australian cricket's ball tampering scandal affect the game's bottom line? And the struggle some veterans face in getting psychiatric help for post-traumatic stress disorder.
There was many, many months delay, and then I think the price was about $320 for our first consultation, which was about a week or 2 weeks' worth of my dole payment.
First to the crisis unfolding in Australian cricket. The ball tampering scandal has seen Test captain Steve Smith suspended for one match, but some veterans of the game and multitudes of fans are calling for heads to roll. It's all come at a sensitive time for the game. Cricket Australia is trying to negotiate a broadcast rights deal worth millions, and it's just months after a bitter pay dispute between the organisation and its players. With major sponsors asking some tough questions, the events in South Africa could cause major damage, both to the bottom line and in the way Australians perceive the sport of cricket. Thomas Ariti reports.
The cricketing world is in shock, and according to some, the cheating controversy could challenge our very perceptions of the game.
People still hold on to this idea that cricket is somehow above other more unpleasant sides of society or indeed other sports.
David Rowe is an emeritus professor of cultural research at Western Sydney University.
I think you have to see all of this in the context of the kind of privileged place of cricket in Australian sports culture. All those extravagant things which are said about the status of the Australian cricket captain being the most important job in the land and so on, cricket being a gentleman's game, should be gentle person's game, of course, but it's got that old Victorian era sense of a gentlemanly game played in the right spirit. And when something like this happens, it does erode that privileged cultural place of cricket in Australia.
Does that have financial repercussions? Do you think that that old Victorian idea of the gentleman's game can have dollars and cents associated with it?
Yes, it does have economic implications because it is part of the brand. It's kind of ironic in a way that its appeal to the old amateur days when people played because they loved the game rather than received very substantial remuneration for being involved in it in all forms of the game, from Test cricket through one day to 2020. That is, if you like, an economic proposition in itself, that it is somehow above economics. And quite clearly, it cannot be so. It is a professional sport. It is supported by big business, by big media, by the public in general that watches the sport on television, goes to the ground. These all are matters which have both social and cultural and economic implications, and they're all rolled into each other.
Those implications could be serious. Cricket Australia is in the middle of negotiations to lock in a broadcast rights deal spanning years and worth millions. And according to sports media rights experts, something like this could affect the organisation's negotiating power. Colin Smith is the managing director of advisory group Global Media and Sports.
Let's put in context first. They're looking for a minimum of a 50% increase. And what they would hope for is 100% increase. Unfortunately, what's happened over the last few days is truly an own goal and actually has ramifications, as they have just sent back to broadcasters to resubmit their bids for the future broadcast rights.
As a former head of the International Cricket Council and the Australian Cricket Board, Malcolm Speed is used to negotiations like this. And he's warned that the crisis has come at a particularly bad time.
It's very, very poor timing. The deal is right at its high point where they're seeking, I think, second round offers. That may be suspended, it may go on. They're judgment calls that Cricket Australia will have to make.
But it's not just the broadcast rights deal. Major sponsors are also asking for an explanation, even if they don't directly support the men's team. The Commonwealth Bank hasn't sponsored the men since last year, but it does sponsor the women's team, Indigenous cricket, cricketers with disabilities, and grassroots cricket. And a spokesman for the bank has told The World Today,
"We are disappointed about the events that have emerged from the third test in South Africa and have asked for a full explanation from Cricket Australia following the conclusion of its investigation into this affair."
But David Rowe from Western Sydney University says talk of the men's team being suddenly unsellable is a bit preemptive.
We have to realise we're in the middle of a kind of media maelstrom at the moment, at the high point of a media sports scandal. And a lot of extreme things are said at such times. There are a lot of people out there making their views clear, some just because they want to express them, some because they have particular interests.
He does, however, point out the impact this scandal could have on the players themselves, just months after a bitter pay dispute with Cricket Australia.
The way that the team, negotiating team, held together and they didn't allow the top players from being split off from the lesser players. That was a significant exercise of kind of collective strength on behalf of the cricketers. Now they've put themselves in a rather weakened position because the leadership team is complicit in this cheating activity.
For media rights expert Colin Smith, Cricket Australia's next move will be crucial.
So the important issue is that Cricket Australia and its players need to address this issue immediately and show immediate contrition. In other words, saying, we've made a major mistakes here and we are going to change the way we do things.
Media rights expert Colin Smith ending that report from Thomas Ariti. The Prime Minister has laughed off questions about the Coalition's poor performance in the polls. The government's still trailing Labor and doesn't yet have the numbers to pass its company tax cuts. Our political reporter Lucy Barber has the latest from Canberra.
When he fronted reporters this morning, the Prime Minister wanted to talk about cybersecurity. But the first question lobbed at Malcolm Turnbull was about the latest news poll result. It's got the Coalition trailing Labor 43-57.
Prime Minister, 29 news polls, it's not good news. How are you
feeling? Why are you smiling then if it's not good news? You're so pleased. You're so pleased. I know why. Because you're so happy about all the jobs we've created.
It's the 29th consecutive news poll that's had Labor ahead. The issue keeps dogging Malcolm Turnbull because he famously cited 30 lost news polls as a reason to boot Tony Abbott out of the top job. But the Prime Minister wasn't keen to dwell on that this morning.
Because you are not distracted by polls. You know that we have created 420,700 jobs in Australia in the last year. And you know... You know that that's the number that we're focused on. We're focused on creating opportunities for Australians. We're focused on getting taxes down. We're seeking to reduce business taxes to allow Australian businesses to invest and compete and create even more great jobs that will make you smile even more. And that's what we're doing. That's our commitment.
The Coalition's trying to turn the attention back to its signature economic policy, company tax cuts, and it's still trying to wrangle enough support from the Senate crossbench to pass them. The change would see the tax rate cut from 30% to 25% for all businesses. Malcolm Turnbull says it'd create jobs.
The way it works is if you have a better return on investment, you get more investment into companies. If you get more investment, you get more jobs, you get more employment.
But Labor's painted the Coalition's policy as an attempt to help out the big end of town. And the Shadow Assistant Treasurer, Andrew Lee, says cutting the company tax rate could reduce jobs.
Firms with a lower effective rate of tax tend to create fewer jobs or, in fact, to be net job destroyers, while firms with a higher effective rate of tax tend to be net job creators.
Labor's trying to sell its own tax policy, which would scrap cash refunds for some shareholders. Pensioners have reacted angrily to the plan, and the opposition looks set to soften its approach. The ABC understands it'll change the policy to ensure poorer pensioners aren't worse off, but there's still no detail on how that would work.
Political reporter Lucy Barber. The Financial Services Royal Commission might be in recess until next month, but for the Commonwealth Bank, the uncertainty continues. Chief Executive Ian Narev and his incoming replacement, Matt Comyn, have announced big changes right at the top of the bank. The ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan has been watching the reaction, and he joins me now. Peter, how significant are these changes given the background of that Royal Commission?
Well, Rachel, significant because the Commonwealth Bank is not only dealing dealing with a Royal Commission into dodgy dealings in the financial sector at the moment, but it's also locked in a legal battle with the financial services regulator AUSTRAC over allegations that it broke anti-money laundering laws on around 54,000 occasions. So, to say the least, the CBA is in permanent issues and crisis mode, and this all becomes Matt Comyn's problem when he takes over as CEO from Ian Narev on the 9th of April. As a result, Matt Comyn is shaking up the CBA executive team. Three key people are leaving in the coming months as he puts his own people in place. Out the door are Melanie Lang, a Group Executive of Human Resources, Kelly Bayer-Rosmarin, Head of Institutional Banking, and David Whiting, the CBA's Chief Information Officer. There are no replacements named just yet, and the CBA says a global search is underway.
So, Peter, how critical is it for that incoming CEO, Matt Comyn, to put his stamp on the Commonwealth Bank?
Well, it is important because one of the big criticisms has been problems with the bank's culture. And in the background, the banking regulator, APRA, is running a separate inquiry into culture, accountability and governance at the CBA, called after those money laundering allegations hit back in August. Now, Mr. Comyn is currently head of retail banking at the CBA, and that's been a big focus of the Royal Commission, as we heard last week, with evidence of poor practices driven by a rush for commissions. So Matt Comyn has a lot to clean up and to preempt before the Royal Commission resumes mid-April. Now, CBA shares are down around 0.5% off the back of that announcement at a 16-week low, but that's in line with the rest of the big four banks.
And Peter, while we have you, how about the rest of the share market? How is that faring with those concerns about that global trade war?
Well, the All Ordinaries Index down around 0.5% in late morning trade. And of course, a potential US trade war with China is continuing to rattle investors.
That's the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. This is The World Today, and if you ever miss a program, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to our podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News, and you can follow me at Rachel Mealy. Polls open in Egypt today, and voters will be faced with an unusual choice: to re-elect President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi or vote for one of his supporters who is certain to lose. President Sisi argues he has delivered security and stability, and a car bomb that killed two policemen on the weekend was a reminder of the threat of violence. But neither candidate has mounted a serious effort in a campaign denounced by a human rights group as neither free nor fair. Middle East correspondent Matt Brown reports from Cairo.
Tahrir Square. 7 years ago, this was the scene of an uprising that helped force a general-turned-president from power after decades of corrupt and brutal rule. Now it's choked with traffic and heavily patrolled by police, backed by military vehicles on one curb. Large posters of the new general-turned-president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, adorn a couple of dilapidated buildings. But they're among just a few symbols of an election that's all but preordained. After leading a coup against the Muslim Brotherhood in 2013, Mr. Sisi is running for a second term. Since the coup, human rights groups say tens of thousands of people have been locked up as part of a sweeping crackdown against Islamists, civil society campaigners and journalists. Potential presidential opponents have been arrested, intimidated or otherwise dissuaded. Mohammed Anwar al-Sadat, the nephew of a former president, says he decided not to run because of bureaucratic roadblocks and the intimidation of his supporters.
This is an election happening whereby there is emergency law, protest law, terrorism law. So you cannot help it. If any of your supporters or any of your campaign members is somehow being stopped or detained or abused, nothing you can do for him.
Mr. Sadat says the election is simply a sham.
There is no chance for any serious candidate. There is no chance for him. They don't want to see candidates whom they will speak out.
However, elections are supposed to provide legitimacy. So just 2 hours before nominations closed, a relatively unknown politician, Musa Mustafa Musa, put himself forward to run as the only challenger. He freely admits that until that moment, he was one of the president's parliamentary supporters.
We wanted him to come again.
You wanted him re-elected?
Re-elected, yes. This was our aim because we are not inventing the wheel. I'm saying the exact situation, what is going on and how we wanted the stability for the country for another 4 years.
And it's fair to say that now that he's thrown his hat into the ring, Musa Mustafa Musa is running what you might generously call a small target campaign, arguing economic reforms went too fast.
What has your opponent, President Sisi, done wrong?
He did not do wrong. He acted very fast in a short period of time.
He didn't do anything wrong?
No, I'm talking about, I'm comparing what about it. But wrong, everybody doing things wrong. So
it's not much of a point of difference, but Mr. Musa says it was essential to offer some sort of competition so the election wouldn't simply be a referendum on President Sisi, threatening an embarrassingly low turnout.
If there is no other candidate, it is going to be catastrophic to the country. Because, believe me, nobody will going to go down to vote.
But most know that whether they cast a ballot or not, they're probably going to get more of the same. And human rights groups are bracing for just that.
Middle East correspondent Matt Brown reporting from Cairo. Back home now, and for many Australian Defence Force veterans, readjusting to civilian life can be difficult. But for some, this minefield is even harder to navigate because they're being turned away when seeking psychiatric help for post-traumatic stress disorder. The World Today has been investigating this, and a warning, this report from Connie Aegis contains some disturbing details.
The sound of an ambulance driving across a bridge or going through a tunnel. They can all trigger anxiety or a panic attack for this former RAAF pilot.
If I get too anxious and I feel that I can't, for example, control a car or control myself, I feel extremely insecure and extremely scared for no apparent reason. And then I'm immediately thinking, oh no, I hope I don't think about the images I saw of the guy with his hands chopped off, or the time they were shoveling up the faces off the bitumen, or thinking about the guys I've seen wounded and dying and in rehab.
The 46-year-old first sought help when he was serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, but only after leaving the Air Force was he diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. And when he reached out for help again in Australia, it wasn't easy.
There was many, many months delay, and then I think the price was about $320 for a first consultation, which was about a week or 2 weeks' worth of my dole payments. And I went, well, it's difficult to pay.
After moving from regional Queensland to Brisbane, he applied to the Department of Veteran Affairs for a white card. It's a government-funded health card, which means that veterans don't have to pay out of their own pocket. But it didn't eliminate all the problems.
I was referred to a psychiatrist who specialised in PTSD issues. When I rang them up and said, can I make an appointment? They went, well, we have to see your referral first. I put down the phone, and within 5 minutes, the receptionist rang me back and said, hey, we found your referral. And I said, great, see you on Tuesday. And she went, no, the doctor is now taking no new patients. And I basically begged her. I said, this is a simple thing. I just need some medication. And she just said no.
Other veterans too have told the ABC they're being turned away when seeking help for post-traumatic stress disorder. Brian Hardigan was in the army for 12 years.
I took the referral phone for an appointment, and his secretary told me straight up, his books have been closed for 4 years. He doesn't take any patients of any type.
And then there was another delay.
So it took me more months to go back to my GP to get a second referral, and I was told that he had appointments available in about 6 weeks' time. So I sent my paperwork to them, and then 2 days later the secretary rang me back and said, I'm very sorry, but doctor is not willing to take on any more DVA patients at this time. That was a slap in the face for someone who had built himself up to actually go through this process.
In a statement, the Department of Veteran Affairs says it's aware that some healthcare providers don't accept DVA arrangements, but doesn't think it's a widespread issue that affects access to clinical treatment. And it adds that there's a steady increase in the number of psychiatrists providing services to veterans. However, the Australian Medical Association acknowledges problems with the system. Its president is Dr. Michael Gannon.
There's no ability for doctors to raise a gap above the DVA schedule, as there is for patients supported by Medicare. And this is another example of the of the long-term consequences of the six-year freeze we've seen on rebates.
The Department of Veteran Affairs says that under current arrangements, psychiatrists are paid 135% of the equivalent Medicare fee. But the AMA argues that's still below the regular fee. And psychiatrists are not allowed to charge a gap for veterans who hold a white card.
People do need to understand that private medical practice is a form of small business with substantial costs, and with the policies of governments from both sides of politics to freeze the money going back to patients, this is coming home to roost. We need to fix it. We need to look at ways of fixing it quick.
A 2014 study by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare found the risk of suicide for young 18 to 24-year-old veterans almost twice that of other men of the same age. It's why Brian Hartigan wants the Department of Veteran Affairs to fix the system.
What if a desperate guy rang up that doctor and got a knockback like that? What if that desperate guy was on the verge of suicide and he was told no DVA allowed? And that's a very scary prospect.
Army veteran Brian Hartigan ending that report from Connie Aegis. And if you or anyone you know need help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Federally, Labor says it's the party of no cuts to education. But in Western Australia, the state Labor government has announced it'll close a public boarding college in the heart of the Wheatbelt. The families of students there say they can't afford upwards of $40,000 to send their children to private schools in the city and want the decision reversed. From Mora in the West Australian Wheatbelt, Eliza Borello reports.
It's just before lunch and the Central Midlands Senior High School swimming carnival is in full swing. But Year 8 student Jack Van Voorst isn't keen on taking part and is more than happy to show us around his boarding house instead.
This is my room. Every room has got a cupboard, a desk, a bed and a bedside cabinet. Pretty basic but still feels like a home away from home.
With small populations in some parts of regional Western Australia, not every town has a public high school. So for children in these towns whose parents can't afford to send them to city private schools, the state has traditionally run public boarding colleges in bigger regional centres like Mora. Jack Van Voorst is one of 26 students who lives at the Mora Residential College and goes to school at the adjacent Central Midlands Senior High School. Built in the 1970s, the college is showing its age, and the State Education Minister Sue Ellery argues the government doesn't have the $8.7 million the previous government was quoted to fix it.
We inherited in Western Australia $40 billion worth of mess from the previous government. And as a consequence of that, we've had to make some really tough decisions.
Labor federally says it's the party of no cuts to education. Do you share that perspective?
Well, I wish that I was in a position where we didn't need to make tough decisions, there's no question about that. The difference between the federal government and the state government, of course, is that we actually deliver education.
Several reports have been written on the condition of the college, and Labor has used them to justify its closure. They point to cracks in the walls, the possibility of asbestos, and since addressed fire safety issues. But the latest engineer's report found the existing buildings are structurally sound. And former college head boy turned Nationals MP Martin Aldridge has confirmed the refurbishment figure Labor is using was simply what the Nationals had set aside to spend on it, not what was absolutely needed to keep it open.
So the project was scoped based on the funding that was available. Obviously the former government didn't have $20 million to rebuild the college available in the fund for residential colleges, but it had an allocation of $8.7 million, which the project was scoped to.
Regardless, the minister argues her decision to close the college also factors in the cost of running it. She says students will have the option of going to other regional colleges. But Jack Van Voorst's mum, Mandy Greiger, says they're several hundred kilometres away and far too far from home.
We are a small community, but we are a close community. We're a community that are going to stick together and fight this till the end. Sue Ellery, Darren West, Mark McGowan, we're not going to back down. You haven't seen the last of us yet.
West Australian parent Mandy Greiger ending Eliza Borello's report. And that's all from the World Today team for this Monday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening at 5 o'clock on RN and on your local ABC station at 6:30. I'm Rachel Mealy. Have a lovely afternoon.